reconvene. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Our second case today is 04AP2542D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Willie J. Nunnery. Representing Mr. Nunnery is Daniel W. Hildebrand. Representing the Officer of Lawyer Regulation is Julie Falk. Mr. Hildebrand.
Thank you, Your Honor. It is always a privilege to appear before this court, and it's a privilege to represent Attorney Nunnery in this matter. I would like to start my argument, because this case really starts out as a Rule 11 sanctions matter, by talking a little bit about sanctions as they are applied under both state and federal procedural rules. It has always been the law, I think, that lawyers are sanctioned under these rules on an objective basis. In other words, there's no intent involved, there's no intent to do harm, there's no intent to harass involved as a general matter, and it's not universally true, but it's fairly consistent with our case law that lawyers may be sanctioned for dropping the ball, for negligent conduct. And these sanction statutes are essentially fee-shifting statutes. Under some circumstances, when the lawyer causes the opposing party to expend fees and costs and all of that, the lawyer has to compensate that other party. I'm sure this court is familiar with the Jandert case, which produced a division in this court. And I think in the aftermath of Jandert, this court felt that there was something wrong with our sanction statutes, the way they were currently being used or misused. So various amendments were adopted to create a safe harbor for lawyers and also to repeal the legislature's version of the sanctions rule, which was 814.025. Now, I would suggest to the court respectfully that if you, as a court, have a concern about sanctions rules and how they're applied, you should be doubly concerned about sanctions rules and how they can lead to discipline of a lawyer, because the imposition of discipline upon a lawyer is much more serious than a lawyer being sanctioned under one of these procedural rules. We all know that the standards for imposing sanctions on a lawyer are and should be much more rigorous than should be less rigorous than when a lawyer is disciplined. And I think it's important now to go to the facts of this case. Attorney Nunnery was sanctioned, and I don't think there's any question about this, and properly so, because of having a frivolous appeal in the Seventh Circuit and submitting these false documents without making an adequate investigation as to the facts. Now, if you look at SCR 3.1, which talks about meritorious claims and contentions, subsection A2 says that it's a violation of the disciplinary rule to knowingly advance a factual position unless there's a basis for doing so that is not frivolous. With regard to these documents, these false documents, the OLR proved that through the sanctions thing that Attorney Nunnery did advance a factual position that without having a basis that was not frivolous, but they did not prove that he knowingly did this. And so the theory of the case is that any lawyer who does such a thing must violate the competence rule. What does that do to SCR 20:3.1A2? It reads it out of the rule. It makes it unnecessary, superfluous. Now let's talk about the Seventh Circuit held that Attorney Nunnery violated Rule 38, which is thou shalt not do a frivolous appeal. We have a similar rule in our procedural rules. Again, 3.1a penalizes that conduct if it's done knowingly. And the OLR did not allege or prove that this frivolous appeal was knowingly done. Instead, they say, well, any lawyer that files a frivolous appeal violates 1.1, which is the competence rule. Now, this court, in the aftermath of Jandert, was very concerned about the delicate balance that is involved in the applications of the sanction rule. Likewise, there has to be an even more delicate balance when a lawyer is up for discipline. The competence rule, 20:1.1, does not require knowledge. It's a rule designed to protect clients. The Chapter 3 SCR rules are designed to protect courts and opposing litigants. So the question that I have to you is, to what extent should a lawyer be disciplined for failure to protect a client from her own fraud? It's not the purpose of the competence rule to protect a client that lies and cheats and puts forth false documents, and the lawyer is a hapless lawyer chooses to believe his client's story. OLR's position would read knowledge out of the rule and would make a lawyer subject to discipline under 1.1 for every case where that lawyer is sanctioned.
Counsel, let me add, I was just reading over the decision of the Seventh Circuit, and they talk about there of a minimally proficient lawyer to file in a lawsuit in face of all of these obvious warning signs. Now, what is, isn't there a balance here that you have?
Yes, there is. And the balance is that this is when it's appropriate to sanction a lawyer through the cost-shifting rules. But it is not appropriate to discipline the lawyer for that unless the additional element of knowledge is proven. Because that's what these rules are designed to do. The big concern here, I think, is that if this court extends the competence rule to cover a situation like this, a sanctions rule, that it would chill a lawyer's advocacy when it involves believing a client over opposing parties. And if you look at the findings of the referee, you'll see there was this fractious disorder that was presented to Attorney Nunnery, which the referee concluded did not have a medical basis. There was another situation involved in the Jimenez case where the defendant had not conducted an investigation. And what it boiled down to, I think, was the fact that Attorney Nunnery did not more closely look at these questionable documents, which he should have. But one of the most poignant things that happened in this trial is that when Attorney Nunnery was adversely examined and questioned closely as to why do you believe your client, and Attorney Nunnery testified that he ordinarily believes his client. Most clients do. And I would like to refer you to pages 182 and 183 of the transcript, where Attorney Nunnery testified that he had a client, or that he had an opposing client, a president of a company, American Champion, federal court in the Eastern District. He says, I never referred to these Hispanics as Mexican wetbacks or spics. He said that in a deposition. He said that in his affidavit with the EEOC. Then a witness came in after all of this and said, yes, sir, Mr. President, you said all these things. Without that witness, there's nothing to contradict the president of the company. 3 days later, the lawsuit gets settled. He says, my clients, these Hispanic witnesses, plaintiffs, barely speaking English, being submitted to the ugliest thing in the world, and you're asking me, do I take their word for it? Yes, I do. It is very, very important that lawyers be, that their advocacy role not be chilled.
Well, Mr. Hildebrand, I'm sure that you have had many a client, plaintiff, or defendant in a lawsuit, and you know that client is going to be subject to cross-examination. And you have probably carefully examined that client in the privacy of your office, so you know the case. That is a basic concept of being prepared. And that you will attempt to see what the weaknesses of the client's cases are. And we'll do that so that you will perform best. And if you just blindly accept everything the client says, that isn't a very competent counsel.
Well, that is true as a general proposition.
Right. And I bet that that's one of the first things stated in all the trial advocacy books about how to be a good trial advocate. And that since the clients don't know the law, they don't know what's important, they may very well forget to tell you something that is either very helpful to their case or very destructive of their case. And that you have to question your client very carefully. And here you had documentary evidence, which I gather from Judge Crabb's comments, if were looked at very carefully, I don't even say very carefully, you'd see that there was a real problem with them.
That certainly is correct, Your Honor. And
oh, I don't know how that chills good advocacy.
Well, the question is when the lawyer makes a mistake and believes the client or believes false information given by the client, I think we can all agree that the sanctions under the fee-shifting statute should be imposed. But then when we get over to the disciplinary rules, do you really want to, does this court really want to hold that when a lawyer is sanctioned, then he can be liable under 1.1. I can't think of a single sanctions case which wouldn't, under the theory of OLR in this case, would not result in a 1.1 violation. And I don't think that this is the way that the law should be developed or should be applied, because
there may be something the matter with your premise. Unfortunately, I had an incident in practice, and we all relate to our own war stories, where client totally defrauded me, and I was about to totally defraud the court. There were no signs, no indication, nothing that would have tipped me that there was a problem there. Nothing at all. I'm not so sure that fees should have been shifted to me if that had been the case, and I don't know that that's the law in this state. And under those circumstances, I would assume that I should not be disciplined for fraud on the court. Didn't know anything.
Reason being that you didn't know.
That's right. Nor did I have reason to know as I presented the facts. But here, there is reason to know.
But OLR did not prove that. There is no knowledge or reason to know element in SCR 20:1.1. If they had proceeded on SCR 3.1A2, then they would have had to prove knowledge or reason to know. But they circumvented the statute or the rule, and that's what makes this case important. I don't think this court should save OLR from a competence charge when OLR should have charged this under 3.1A2 and should have been required to prove knowledge or reason to know. That is our position, because otherwise, if you have a rule of law that talks about competence in the context of sanctions and don't require OLR to prove knowledge or reason to know, you will chill advocacy. And furthermore, I think you would also chill trial judges from sanctioning lawyers, because they would believe that any lawyer that is sanctioned would be guilty of a lack of competence and be required to report that lawyer to OLR, and discipline would certainly follow. I would urge this court not to chill trial judges from awarding sanctions in a proper case by allowing OLR to simply prove the sanction and the lack of competence which led to the sanction.
Counsel, if I recall correctly in this case, and we're focusing now on Judge Crabb and what she said, I think that she singled out the case as being the most blatant example of a Rule 11 violation. That's one thing she said. But then she went on to say, finally, because the facts of this case disclose legal representation so far below the minimum standards required of lawyers, I'm sending a copy of this opinion and order to the Office of Lawyer Regulation. So that suggests to me that it was so far below minimal competence. So why wouldn't that? Why do you take fault for OLR bringing a claim regarding competence, given Judge Crabb's comments?
Because I don't think the competence rule is designed to cover this sort of thing. Attorney Nunnery was sanctioned for not following through and more closely examining false documents submitted by his client. But there were some other factors here. There was this fractious disorder thing, which the referee looked at and said that the defendants were not justified in doing this. There's also the problem that when you get into these discrimination cases, I think it's well known that the defense and defense counsel will frequently say that they're frivolous, will frequently use intimidation tactics. And that's what happened in that case that I referred to earlier, that Attorney Nunnery testified to. So in the big picture here, sure, Judge Crabb was legitimately upset at the fact that this was a frivolous case and sanctioned Attorney Nunnery for it. But there's nothing in her referral opinion that says that Attorney Nunnery knew that what he did was wrong or had really reason to know within the context of SCR 3.1A2. Any judge who refers a sanctions case to OLR will obviously think that the lawyer did not perform competently. It's just as night follows day. And I think that's true. And the question for this court is really, do you want to let OLR use the competence rule as a device to avoid what they should be required to prove under 3.1A? Okay. I think that would be bad public policy, and it would chill advocacy.
You think these two are mutually exclusive, that if it falls, it may fall under 3.1A2, you can't bring it under 1?
Yes.
That's what your view is, they're mutually exclusive.
Yeah,
it's not the general view of in statutes or in rules, because you can have the same conduct violate one or more rules, and they're not mutually exclusive.
Well, Your Honor, I would just answer that by saying that any sanction situation would involve a violation of 1.1 if that's what the court would hold. Where could a lawyer be sanctioned and not violate 1.1 if you're going to interpret 1.1 to excuse OLR from proving what has to be proved under 3.1?
There was a time, if I'm remembering correctly, when there was great concern in the bar that every time there was a sanction for frivolous defense or frivolous claim, that OLR would act. And there was, as I understand or remember it, maybe you'll remember it better or differently, an agreement that every, by OLR and maybe even this court, that not every sanction for frivolousness constituted a violation of the code.
Right.
Is that, my memory that is roughly correct?
Your memory is absolutely correct. And I think that, I think your memory is bolstered by the earlier opinions in this court in Summer versus Carr, where that concern is expressed. And then in the Lauer case, which drew the distinction between a sanction based on an objective basis and a discipline which was based on something more than that.
Right. And furthermore, my memory is that the general concept of the competence issue is that ordinarily one form of negligence, usually missing a statute of limitations, does not mean that under 1.1, that's an incompetence, competent lawyer. So what you have here is a situation that seems much more aggravated than inadvertence in missing a statute of limitations, but going ahead with a claim when rather simple investigation would have shown that this was based on bad documents.
Sure, the lawyer was negligent. And what I'm respectfully suggesting to Your Honor is that OLR wants to go back to the old way. They want to look at every sanctions issue, and then they want to, if they can't prove knowledge, then they want to have the lawyer disciplined under 1.1, because any lawyer who's negligent and gets himself and his client into a sanctioned situation does not perform competently, as the word is commonly understood. And when you have rules like 3.1, which are very specific, and a general rule like you have in 1.1, I think the specific has to overcome the general. Otherwise, you have the opposite problem. You're reading 3.1A2 and 3.1A1 out of the code. It will become totally unnecessary for OLR to ever use those again.
Counsel, let's set the Jimenez case aside and the argument of 1.1 or 3.1. 60 days is what I think is being asked for as a discipline. Here you have several clients. You know, forget Jimenez. You have Triggs. You have Andrews. You have Decker. You have Petrie. You have Russell. Several clients who matters have languished for years, some with cases that were dismissed for inaction. Now, if it were one client, I'd say, oh, you know, that shouldn't happen. Two clients, well, that surely shouldn't happen. Three clients, that shouldn't happen absolutely. Four clients, five clients, and you're not contesting, as I understand, those cases at all. Am I right or wrong that you're not contesting
them? Let me make this observation. Yes, you are right.
Okay.
But these violations were explained by the referee as to why they weren't serious. And frankly, the OLR overcharged Attorney Nunnery in many of these counts, and the referee pointed that out. And the referee thoroughly explained why these cases didn't rise to the level above a private reprimand, with the exception of the Petri case, which he said might justify a public reprimand. And
what about the cumulative effect, though? That always, you know, as a trial court judge, that always would concern me. If one person complains, well, it might be a credibility contest.
Well,
three people, I mean, you've got a lot of different people complaining.
The first of these cases arose in 1997. The evidence was stale even by the time the grievance committee investigated it. Then the OLR sat on that report for 2 or 3 years before charges were brought, thereby not only impeding Nunnery's defense, but this woman couldn't remember anything. So, yes, you're correct if you say it's cumulative, but also if you have one small problem here 1 year, another small problem the following year, another small problem 2 years later, heavens, we all make mistakes. This is not, one of these charges is that Attorney Nunnery took a $200 check and instead of putting in his trust account, he didn't cash it and left it in the file. No, the client never lost any money. The client's check was negotiated. I'm not going to sit here and argue the court that that isn't even a violation of the trust account rule. $200 isn't worth this court's time or my time. But the referee, I think, was certainly accurate and persuasive, the way I read his opinion, that these other cases were at most private and public reprimand cases. Well, the red light is on, Justice.
Time goes quickly.
Do you want to pursue me any further?
thank you, Mr. Hildebrand. Julie M. Falk, representing the Office of Lawyer Regulation Counsel.
Just give me a second. I'll lower this so you can at least see my face a little bit and hear me as well. May it please the Court. My name is Julie M. Falk, and I represent the Office of Lawyer Regulation in the pending disciplinary proceeding. Before I go into, well, first, let me just go over the standard of review with regard to this case. It is important to note that Nunnery did admit to a majority of the factual allegations regarding the entire complaint in this matter. Including the Jimenez matter, he admitted to a majority of the facts in that matter, except for one fact. And consequently, the referee's decision or legal conclusion that he engaged in incompetent representation was based upon admitted facts made by Mr. Nunnery. He does not dispute any of the facts presented before this court today. First, Mr. Nunnery brought up the sanction issue, and I'll just briefly discuss that with the court. With regard to the sanction issue, Nunnery is focusing the sanction on this one issue, whether OLR proved an SCR 20:3.1A3 violation. And I would like to emphasize, as Justice Bradley did as well, that we are not just talking about one violation here. We are talking about Mr. Nunnery being found to having engaged in misconduct with regard to 13 allegations in 6 client matters. Nunnery attempts to belittle his misconduct and minimize it, but neglecting a client's case for over 2 years is not minimal when a client is sitting
Counselor,
there.
Counselor, if we were to agree with Mr. Hildebrand's analysis of just the Jimenez matter and agree with you on all of the other matters, would it still be OLR's recommendation that there be a suspension?
Yes, Justice.
Why is that?
That is because at that point in time, Nunnery still would have engaged in 12 misconduct allegations with regard to 5 clients. That is a significant amount of misconduct. We're talking about client neglect. We're talking about fee violations. In one of the matters, I believe it was the Russell matter, he did file 2 frivolous suits before the court after the statute of limitations on those cases had already been gone by. He also engaged in incompetence in the Russell matter after being reminded over and over again by the court and opposing counsel that he had to file a substitution. He failed to do so. He neglected his client's cases. He failed to communicate with his clients. There were judgments entered against his clients. This is not just the, in regards to sanction, this is not just the Hinnemann's matter. This is his neglect and his misconduct with regard to five other clients as well. And it didn't just include neglect, it included frivolousness, it included incompetence. Those are serious allegations, which he is not appealing at this point in time.
Now, the referee found that OLR had not met the burden of a violation of 3.1A3.
That is correct.
Okay. It did find that in the Jimenez case that OLR did meet the burden of showing that Mr. Nunnery did not provide competent representation. That's count 10.
That's correct.
The referee then said that if it were not for the respondent's grossly inadequate representation in the Jimenez matter, I would have recommended a public reprimand. You disagree with that?
I respectfully disagree with the referee. I have reviewed the public reprimand cases, both by this court as well as the ones provided by Mr. Hildebrand, and Nunnery's conduct is definitely much more serious than that of a public reprimand. He did bring up two cases, which were the Casperis case and the Theobald case. Those two cases were public reprimands. Casperis committed 16 counts of misconduct. However, in Casperitz, Casperitz's misconduct was mitigated by the fact that he had medical and emotional problems. Theobald engaged in 13 counts of misconduct involving four clients receiving a public reprimand. However, her misconduct only included client neglect. It's the OLR's position that Nunnery's misconduct here is much more serious in that, one, he still was found to have filed frivolous lawsuits in this case, and he also engaged in incompetent representation, which is not disputed today by Mr. Nunnery. Nunnery has repeatedly minimized the misconduct that he's engaged in, and he's been practicing law for 30 years. At this point in the game, Mr. Nunnery should not be filing frivolous lawsuits or engaging in incompetent representation.
Counselor, Mr. Nunnery's never had any prior disciplinary action, correct?
That's correct.
So for 35 years, he must have been, except for what we have before us, a fairly upstanding lawyer, correct?
You know, I wouldn't be able to say that. I can say that he has not been charged by the OLR within those 30 years. I don't know.
Doesn't that bear on the kind of discipline that the OLR generally recommends when it's a lawyer of long standing and this is the first disciplinary proceeding?
Well, I would bring this court's attention to the Goldstein case, which the OLR feels that this case is substantially similar to, in which Mr. Goldstein also had no prior disciplinary history and received a 4-month suspension of his license for engaging in 12 counts of misconduct, including lack of diligence, failure to communicate with his clients, and failing to explain his fee arrangement to his clients. And this involved 6 client matters. I believe that that case is substantially similar to the case that we have before us today. If this was merely a case involving client neglect, yes, maybe it would be a public reprimand case, but we're not just dealing with client neglect in this case. We're dealing with multiple instances of misconduct involving, I think it's very serious, the allegations concerning the frivolous claims and the incompetence
but
claims.
But you didn't prove violation of 3.1.
We did with regard to one matter. That was the case in which there was the city, the Russell matter, in which he filed the lawsuit after the statute of limitations expired. He then dismissed that lawsuit and then again filed a second lawsuit against the city. And in that case, the referee did find that he violated 20:3.1 and did file frivolous claims.
What about the Andrews matter? Was that another matter where there was, that was the raising of property in Kenosha?
That's the matter I'm speaking of,
yeah.
Yes.
Okay,
the Andrews matter is the matter in which the 20:3.1 violation was found.
They found that it was a frivolous.
Correct.
That he knowingly advanced a frivolous claim.
Correct. And then also in the Russell matter where he was repeatedly reminded throughout the course of the lawsuit that he needed to file a substitution of counsel. He failed to do so. The referee in this matter found that he engaged in incompetent representation, resulting in the dismissal of his client's claim. So we're not just talking about neglect of client matters. We're talking about more serious allegations here. What I would like to go to is to address the SCR 20:1.1 violation. OLR, with regard to the 20:1.1 violation, is not creating a per se rule that every attorney has to discover a client's fraud. We could even take a client's fraud out of this case in discussing whether or not Nunnery violated SCR 20:1.1. Under SCR 20:1.1, a lawyer has to provide competent representation that includes thoroughness and preparation reasonably necessary for the representation. There's no knowledge requirement as alleged by Nunnery. Nunnery does not have to know that his client is committing a fraud upon him. It's his lack of knowledge in this case which brings up the incompetence.
Counselor, do you agree with opposing counsel that 1.1 is meant to protect clients?
1.1 is meant to protect clients.
And does that agreement have any bearing on counsel's argument that should it be used then to protect a client who actively defrauded his own lawyer?
I think that in this instance that Nunnery had a duty to protect Jimenez with regard to her own fraud. Nunnery was presented with blatant, obvious evidence that his client was committing fraud. He had a duty under SCR 20:1.1 to investigate and conduct discovery as to whether or not his client was fraudulently or was not being honest with him with regard to her claims.
Counselor, didn't these same claims originally get filed in federal court by Attorney Hal Harlow?
Not that I'm aware of.
Have you checked the circuit court records in that regard?
I have not.
Thank you.
But in this case, he had a duty to discover whether or not the evidence that she was presenting was fraudulent. If he determined that it was fraudulent, he had a duty to notify his client that he believed that she was bringing fraudulent claims and that under those circumstances, he could no longer represent her in this case. If she continued to insist on pursuing with it, at least he informed her of his opinion and advised her that he didn't think it would be in her best interest to continue with those claims. She could hire other counsel or she could dismiss the case. Instead, what he did was he made his client believe by proceeding with the case that his client had valid claims, drug her through the lawsuit, resulting in sanctions being entered against her, drug her through district court proceedings up to the Seventh Circuit. If he would have discovered that she was bringing fraudulent claims, and if he would have ended the lawsuit at an earlier date, his client would not have had to go through all of this, the entire lawsuit. So I think that in some respect, finding that his client engaged in fraud, there was a duty there that he do so and that he notify the client that he was aware of it and that she shouldn't proceed with the matter, because it did, in the end, result in harm to the client.
Counsel, I'm interested in the concept that 20:1.1 goal or underlying premise is to protect the client. I always viewed all of these, 20:1, to also protect the concept of the lawyer as an officer of the court. And the preamble, the reason I think that, was the preamble says that these rules encompass the concept that there might be conflicting responsibilities. And so is it right to say that that it's a violation of 1.1 or 1.2 or 1.3 as to diligence and promptness, for example? That's a good one. Isn't that also to protect the court and the office's duty as a court? So you might be serving the client, but in doing so, don't serve the court.
Justice, I agree with you completely. It's the OLR's position in this case that not only by violating SCR 20:1.1 did Mr. Nunnery breach his obligations to his client, but he also breaches obligations to opposing counsel and to the court by proceeding with the lawsuit.
And he doesn't do the client very much good if he's proceeding in a frivolous claim, because ultimately, one, the client has expended a great deal of emotion and energy, and two, could be sacked with fees.
That's correct. And I agree with that.
Even when the client is defrauding the lawyer.
That's correct. And here, Nunnery was faced with numerous allegations from the other side that his client was fabricating her claims. He was presented with suspicious laminated documents, which he admits. He was presented with affidavits from the individuals who wrote these documents, indicating that they did not draft these documents. In some of the affidavits, the individuals didn't even know what some of the terminology meant. He was presented with the documents, which were inconsistent in that they had the wrong date and day of the week on them. They were cut off. They started on separate pages. He was presented with an IME indicating that his client had factitious disorder. And in spite of all of that evidence, Nunnery did nothing. He didn't conduct any discovery.
Let me just ask you, because this bothers me a little bit. You've got a situation where MATC people are claiming that this is fraudulent. My understanding is that Mr. Nunnery confronts his client. His client says, no, everything I'm telling you is true. What I've given you is correct. What is the attorney supposed to do at that point? Is he supposed to hire an investigator? Is he supposed to stop the lawsuit and dismiss it? Is he supposed to continue on to see what develops in terms of testimony? I'm asking you, what is OLR's position? What is the attorney to do under the circumstances at the point that this all comes up?
Under those circumstances, an attorney can't just idly sit back and fully believe what his client is informing him.
Well, should he have hired an investigator? Is that what you're saying?
He should have conducted discovery in the suit. He could have had the documents that he had analyzed.
No discovery performed here?
No, he conducted no discovery. He did not depose any of the affiants who indicated that they didn't draft the documents. He could have conducted discovery of the computers to determine if those documents even came from MATC computers. He could have conducted a deposition of the doctor to determine whether or not the doctor felt to a degree of medical probability that his client had factitious disorder and that she was not telling the truth with regard to
these claims. Was there discovery conducted by MATC?
No.
Nobody did any discovery?
MATC did ask for the documents, which Nunnery never provided to them.
Well, according to Judge Crabb, he should have just looked at the documents because they were apparently faked on their face.
Correct. I mean, it would be the OLR's position that based upon all the evidence presented to Mr. Nunnery, he should have had some indication that his client was lying to him and was fabricating her claims. I believe that Justice Crabb in the Western District of Wisconsin stated that any minimally competent lawyer would have subjected his client to rigorous questioning and corroborated details before proceeding. Nunnery did not do that in this case. Essentially, Nunnery went back to his client, said, are these documents real? His client said yes, he believed her, and he proceeded with the lawsuit. He did nothing at all to determine whether or not the documents were fabricated, which he had an obligation to do under SCR 20:1.1. He has a duty to investigate the facts of the matter to determine whether or not his client had a legitimate claim. He had a duty to evaluate the evidence to determine if the evidence was valid. He failed to do so. SCR 20:1.1, contrary to Nunnery's arguments, is not designed to protect an attorney who turns a blind eye to the fact that his client is lying and has falsified documents. An attorney needs to do something when faced with evidence of client fabrication. We're not talking about a case here, as Justice Abramson brought out before, where a client lies to the attorney and there's no evidence presented to the attorney that the client is fabricating their story. Under some circumstances, a client will lie. An attorney will believe that client and the attorney has no evidence to the contrary. Under those circumstances, the attorney wouldn't be found incompetent, because the attorney was not faced with any evidence that his client was fabricating their story. Here, this is a clear situation where Nunnery was presented with the evidence and failed to do nothing. If in this case, Nunnery had, after receiving all of this information, if he had taken depositions of the affiants, if he had possibly conducted the discovery of the computers, if he did have somebody analyze the emails and the letters to determine whether or not they were fabricated or if they were real documents, if he had taken a deposition of the doctor who conducted the IME to determine whether or not, in fact, his client had a factitious disorder.
Counselor, even if someone has a factitious disorder, that's not proof that in a particular case that person lied, correct?
That's correct, and okay, that's why Nunnery was obligated to take the deposition of that doctor to determine what the doctor's determinations were with regard to the client.
But he couldn't make a determination, the doctor, in regard to whether the client lied in this particular instance. So what good would the deposition have done?
Well, he could have taken the deposition of the doctor. He could have had her analyzed by another doctor to determine whether or not that doctor felt that she had factitious disorder. He received a letter from opposing counsel indicating that that doctor was going to testify to a degree of medical probability that Ms. Jimenez was fabricating all of this evidence.
You think that would have been admissible, that the doctor can testify in a particular case that a person lied in this instance just because they testified to a reasonable medical certainty that they have a fabricating disorder?
Well, that would have been an issue for the court to decide. I'm not here to decide whether or not that was admissible. But, okay. but what I'm stating is that if a client has factitious disorder and is subject to lying in order to gain something for him or herself, then he has an obligation to at least look into that or conduct some discovery into that. And as a whole, as I was saying, I mean, if he had done a minimal amount of discovery with regard to the allegations brought against his client, if he had taken depositions, if he had looked at the documents more closely, we would not be here today. We would not be arguing that he engaged in incompetent representation of a client, because he would have, as stated in the rule, evaluated the evidence. He would have investigated the facts of the matter. In this instance, he didn't, and that's why we're here today. When faced with these facts in front of him, Nunnery just can't sit idly back and do nothing. He has to take some action. He has to conduct some discovery. And the referee properly concluded that he did not do so in this case based upon Nunnery's own admissions. I mean, if you look at the comments from the Western District, I know some of these were already reiterated by this court, but they indicated that the documents were obviously fraudulent, that this is truly without any competition the most blatant case of a Rule 11 violation, and both the Nunnery and his client share the blame. The district court indicated to the OLR that the facts of this case disclose legal representation so far below the minimal standards required of lawyers. Just quickly, because my time is coming up, just to address the issue of SCR 20:1.1 violations and SCR 20:3.1 violations, there are instances where this court has found that an attorney both acted incompetently and engaged in frivolous litigation. You can look at the Wadooley case, where Wadooley was found to have violated SCR 20:1.1 as well as 3.1A3 and 3.1A2, where he took action on behalf of a client to harass or maliciously injure another by not looking into whether or not his client had a valid security agreement before he filed the lawsuit, not conducting any research into whether or not the defendants had valid affirmative defenses in that action. Also in, I believe it is Lesperance also violated 3.1 and 1.1, where in the course of a legal action, he filed numerous motions, some of which the court found without basis, ordering the client to pay $10,000 in attorney's fees. In Fisher, although he wasn't found to have violated 3.1, he did engage in a Rule 11 violation with regard to his misconduct, and this court found that he did violate 20:1.1. In Fisher executed complex complaints and briefs on behalf of persons without communicating with them, without examining their case files, without seeking to discover the basis of allegations and arguments set forth in the complaints and briefs, and without any independent assessment of their legal sufficiency. Consequently, he was found to have engaged in incompetent representation. So, in answer to this court, an attorney can be found to violate both 3.1 and 1.1, can be found to have violated 3.1 separate of 1.1 or 1.1 separate from 3.1. I mean, It just depends on the facts and circumstances of the case. OLR did proceed in this case and argue that Nunnery did violate 3.183. However, based upon a subjective standard as opposed to the objective standard, which was utilized by the district court, the referee felt, as a matter of credibility, that Nunnery did not act maliciously in this action and did not intend to harass MATC personnel, and that's an issue of credibility, and the OLR in this matter chose not to appeal that decision. The OLR does feel that a suspension is appropriate in this action for the reasons that I've stated before, that Nunnery did engage in multiple instances of misconduct that involving six client matters. Nunnery has, as I've emphasized previously, he's belittled his misconduct and does not feel that his conduct is serious enough to warrant a suspension of his license. His conduct was serious. I mean, clients were neglected, cases were dismissed, clients received liens against their properties, received judgments against them. Clients were drugged through frivolous claims. He did engage in serious misconduct, and because he fails to recognize this, the OLR feels that a suspension of his license is necessary to impress upon Mr. Nunnery the seriousness of the conduct that he did engage in. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Falk. Mr. Hildebrand, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
In response, there's no factual basis for the argument that Ms. Jimenez was not was dragged through this and dragged through that because Nunnery failed to do this and failed to do that. Jimenez never made a complaint. She never testified. And I quoted on page 16 of my brief the Seventh Circuit that says, in light of the willful and malicious nature of Jimenez's flagrant Rule 11 violations, we hold that the decision to dismiss her case as a sanction of her abusive conduct was within the bounds of the trial court decision.
Counsel, since you have your brief in front of you, would you turn to page 7, please? Right. The very last paragraph of page 7 starts as follows. In January 1998, Nunnery filed an action against MATC in the United States District Court for the Western District of Wisconsin, voluntarily dismissing the action after MATC filed a motion to dismiss. Judge Crabb's decision contradicts that. Judge Crabb's decision says in January 1998, plaintiff brought suit against these defendants alleging a violation of her civil rights. Her counsel at that time was Hal Harlow. After defendants moved to dismiss, plaintiff dismissed her suit voluntarily.
Well,
Who is correct, and what difference does it make?
I don't think it makes any difference, and I don't frankly know who's correct.
Okay.
But I would like to say this. I heard counsel for the OLR talk about Nunnery's duty to take discovery and investigate. There was outstanding discovery at the time which OLR did not respond to. And I think it's very important to look at paragraph 77A of the referee's report, which is on page A8 of the appendix, where he talks about the medical report on the fractious disorder and concludes, he says, nor does the record demonstrate it was reasonable for defense counsel to make such claims to Nunnery. So here we have the referee concluding that part of the demands here that were being made by defense counsel were unreasonable. And this kind of goes on in a lot of these cases where there'll be this pushing and shoving back and forth as to your case is good or your defense is frivolous and all of that. I want to make one thing very clear. Counsel says that Attorney Nunnery minimizes his conduct. That is totally wrong. What he did was he admitted much of his misconduct and expressed remorse for it. That's what this record says. But when OLR overcharges him, for example, in the Andrews matter, they charged him with two frivolous claims. The referee only found that one of them was frivolous, but then said, and I'll refer to page A31 of the appendix, he said, all it did was help achieve a good result for the client without making literally a federal case out of it. Again, I'd have to be persuaded that something other than a private reprimand would be appropriate response. And then with regard to the Russell matter, at appendix page 41, here's again a situation where the referee overcharged, OLR overcharged Nunnery by saying that when he said that he didn't get something in the mail, that he didn't have the right to contest it, even though the judge found that it was mailed. Referee Decker says, I tremble to think that any time a court makes a factual determination in a lawsuit contrary to the lawyer's position, that the lawyer is ethically exposed. So what is a respondent to do in an OLR proceeding? Just fold down and say, I'm guilty, guilty, guilty of everything, even though he's overcharged? That is what happened here. And I think Nunnery ought to be commended for admitting all of the things that he didn't do that were not right. But to say that he's minimizing his conduct because OLR has overcharged him is not correct. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Hildebrand, and thank you, Ms. Falk, for your arguments in this case. 04AP2542D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Willie Nunnery, is now concluded. The court.
Can I just make one last point? Wadooley did not come to a decision on competence.
Pardon?
The Wadooley case, which is the court did not make a decision on competence.
Thank you. That concludes our hearing, and we are in recess until 1:30.